Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hour number two of your Ben Jarofsky show for Tuesday, January 21st. Got it right this time, Brianna. It's just moments away. But before we get into that, we need to thank the following unions again for jumping on board and sponsoring our program. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, they sponsor the show, as well as the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, not Aerosmith, Local 126, and District 8. A giant thank you to those unions for jumping on board and sponsoring this program. And, of course, today's Ben Jarofsky Show is brought to you by our good friends at the Chicago Federation of Labor. Troy, you looking for something?
Headphones.
Headphones? Oh, I'll take care of that.
Okay.
The Ben Jarofsky Show, hour number two, starts right now. It is Tuesday, January 21st, and live from the Chicago Sun-Times Chicago Reader Studio on Racine Avenue, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. In this hour of the program, one man and one man only. It's the long-awaited return of President of the Chicago Principals Association, Mr. Troy LaRavier. And now your host, one man, and believe me when I say, one man only, Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Troy LaRavier is in the studio. They got a ton of questions. I just wrote them down. Then I'm going to ask Troy, including, I'm going to start off with a Martin Luther King Day question.
Everybody just wrote them down, huh?
Yeah, I just wrote them down.
Well, now.
They were in my head. and I just wrote them down. I was just watching Joe Rogan interview Bill Maher the other day.
People.
And by the way, that was not one of the best. I'm just throwing that out there.
No, he was very, very smart. Negative.
Yeah, it was just not Rogan in a show at its best. But anyway, Maher was really impressed that Joe Rogan didn't write down any questions. It's a two-hour interview, Troy. It's twice as long as we're going to do today. And Joe Rogan, who's one of the most popular podcasters in America, did not have one question written down. He just let it go. So I'm of the Rogan school. But I do this mostly so I won't forget. And then, things I want to pick Troy's brain about. And then, of course, one thing leads to another, and I get through half the list. Anyway, before we bring Troy on, you got an update for us?
Absolutely, I do. And boy, our host is one hell of a political nerd. And I'll prove it right now that Ben Jarofsky is a political nerd.
Well, that's
when I hear these two words, I just go, I don't know. Slush fund.
Oh, is this a story about TIFs?
Oh, yes, sir. 4 years ago, the city council... Oh, the following comes from the Chicago Sun-Times and the one and only Fran the Woman Spielman. 4 years ago, the city council signed off on Rahm Emanuel's plan to generate a pot of money to rebuild struggling neighborhoods.
Neighborhood Opportunity Fund.
At the expense of downtown developers. Despite concerns it would create a mayoral, quote, slush fund. Ben, calm down. Akin to a tax increment financing, Alderman agreed to let developers in a broader downtown area build bigger and taller projects so as long as they agree to share the wealth with long-ignored South and West Side neighborhoods. Now Mayor Lightfoot is making Emanuel's Robin Hood program her own with reforms tailor-made to fuel her $250 million plan to bring, quote, transformative change to 10 South and West Side neighborhoods.
All right. This actually happens to be the subject of a column I just wrote yesterday, which will run tomorrow. The Neighborhood Opportunity Fund. Ah, my beloved city of Chicago. How do I explain this, Troy? The idea for writing a column on this subject came when I heard Lori Lightfoot last week talking at the city council in a remarks I, for the most part, really agreed with. She was criticizing aldermen for their silliness in some of the things they were saying and their nastiness and what they were saying regarding set-asides for businesses owned by gays, lesbians, etc. And in the middle of that, she says, we can slice the pie here in Chicago for everyone. And I just, when that metaphor of pie slicing is something I always talk about, how we divvy the pie.
Right.
And I have dedicated so many years of writing stories about how unfairly we divvy the pie. So the notion that Chicago could suddenly, overnight, fairly divvy a pie or slice the pie is preposterous. And case point, number one on the list is the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund, which is where they slap a fee on a developer who gets a zoning approval. If you had been elected mayor, you would be dealing with this. And then that money gets channeled into a fund, which is used to finance entrepreneurs on the South and West sides. Mm-hmm. Mayor Rahm worked himself out with exhaustion, patting himself on the back every time he had a press conference once a year or so where they would dole out these awards. Okay. And in reality, so while they're doling out these awards, meanwhile, they're funneling $1.3 billion to Lincoln Yards. So again, Neighborhood Opportunity Fund is predicated on the notion that Chicagoans are not very bright. And they'll be really impressed and wowed by a press conference in which you pat yourself on the back for giving like $47 million over the course of several years to the South and West Side while you're giving $1.3 billion. Like, Chicagoans don't know the difference between $1.3 billion and $47 million. That is what the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund is dedicated to.
The other thing you have to think about is sort of the scope of where that $47 million goes and the scope of where that $1 billion or $1.7 billion goes. It was actually, this program was actually a talking point of mine when I was campaigning, because at the time when I was still in, $11 million had been spent that year in the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund. $11 million for the entire South and West Side.
$11 million.
That's the point you have to have with that. For the entire South and West Side, $11 million. And I can go over here to Wintrust Arena and see an amount invested in that one arena that quadruples that $11 million in terms of the public money that was put in it.
Yes, public money, correct.
In terms of the public money that was put in it. You put 4 to 5 times more public money into one project in one block than you did the entire South and West Sides of Chicago. That's how I help people to see just how inadequate the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund is in relationship to other funds that pad the pockets of developers, and two, the need on the South and West Sides.
Yeah, no, and it's, again, I'll get your thoughts on this. It's really a very cynical thing. The notion that you can hold a press conference to pat yourself on the back for giving, doling out $47 million to the entire West and South Sides, while ignoring the fact that you got $1.3 billion going to this little corner of the North Side. Mm-hmm. And we're not, yeah, you're right. The Wintrust, the DePaul Basketball Arena, the Marriott Hotel, the money, the TIF money that went to Navy Pier, they're all of it dwarfs the $47 million. So the notion that you could pat yourself on the back by doing something that just sort of proves the point that the pie is not being sliced up fairly, while pretending as though you are slicing up the pie fairly, suggests that you really think the public is stupid, because they can't tell the difference between $47 million and $1.3 billion.
And that you have no real commitment to addressing the actual need, because $47 million is not going to do on the South and West Sides what is needed on the South and West Sides. You have to have someone in there with a vision of investing billions of dollars in those neighborhoods. And that's not what we have. It's not what we had before, and it's not what we have now.
Well, I'm going to give a shout out. I did end this column with a little hope. Maurice Cox, who was on Franz Billen's show last week, he's a new planning commissioner. And when asked about funneling out an untold tens of millions of dollars for some in TIF monies for projects that would build a barrier over the a top on the expressway so you can put a high rise, said, that money would be better spent on in black communities in the Southwest. So there's, I've never heard a planning commissioner talk that way, Troy. So I'm trying to be hopeful. I was very impressed that he said that. I, you know, that just goes to show you how low the bar is in the city of Chicago. But I was impressed because I've never heard a planning commissioner talk
in
that way.
City, right.
Yeah, in this city, they usually like can't wait to give the money.
Is that the one that came from Detroit?
That is correct. He's from Detroit. All right. You got any more updates, D?
February 4th, first Tuesday, 1354, West Wabanzia. Carlos Ramirez Rosa versus Brandon Johnson. The debate of the century.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren versus Bernie Sanders. We'll get Troy's thoughts on all that in a little while. But I want to start Martin Luther King Day yesterday. That's the one day a year where everybody gets together, holds hands, and say how much they love each other. And then as soon as the day's over, they go back to fighting each other. Talk about cynical acts. Today's article, though, I had to share this with you, Troy. Pro-gun rally of thousands in Virginia ends peacefully. I don't know if you saw this. This is the part that I was reading the story about. Tens of thousands of gun right activists from around the country rallied peacefully on Martin Luther King Day. So gun rights, Al, let's just think about that for a moment.
Okay.
Martin Luther King, of course, for our younger listeners, was killed in 1968, assassinated, shot by a sniper. So there's a gun rights rally on Martin Luther King Day, and they're shouting USA, and they're heavily armed. There was one gentleman who was particularly popular. He was a truck driver from Richmond who was carrying an AR-15 rifle just outside of Capitol Square. He said, "I love this. This is like the Super Bowl for the Second Amendment." He, and I'm reading from this article from the Associated Press, he was one of the few African-American rally goers in a crowd that was overwhelmingly white and male and was frequently stopped and asked to pose for pictures because he's wearing his, quote, Black Guns Matter sweatshirts. Wow. Any thoughts on that one, that little riff? Black Guns Matter sweatshirt, very popular with the crowd. Everybody wants to take their picture with him.
I got nothing, man. I'm speechless. You've accomplished it. No one has ever made me speechless before. You have made me. I'm speechless, man.
I'd be surprised. What would the reaction have been if he'd been wearing a Black Lives Matter? I raised this.
I mean, it's interesting that, you know, the NRA itself is pretty quiet when the gun rights of black citizens are violated. You know, like Philando Castile, you know, he was legally carrying his gun and was killed as a result of it. And the NRA didn't say a thing. Gun rights activists didn't say a thing. Not one peep out of any of them. When it was a black person being killed by having his gun rights, his rights to carry an arms violated. So that's an interesting thing to juxtapose against those same people who were silent on Philando Castile coming to ask this black man to pose with him. You know, and I think it was more for his shirt than it was for his gun rights. I think it was, I think people probably posed with that man more because of what his shirt implied about black lives than what it said about black people's rights to carry guns. If I'm making any sense, I think if he had a shirt that said, that explicitly said something about sort of like black people have gun rights too, right? Like something like that. No one would have asked for that. It was because it said black guns matter as opposed to black lives. That's why people want, they didn't give a damn about his right to carry an arm. They liked the fact that it seemed to be a message against Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, absolutely. He was trivializing and mocking the rallying cry that has you've been hearing for the last, 5 years? Ever since Ferguson, Black Lives Matter. So he's mocking that by wearing a shirt that says Black Guns Matter.
I don't know if he was mocking it intentionally. It certainly does mock it. I know the people who embraced it and wanted to pose with it or certainly mocking it. You know, as far as he's concerned, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But I'm fairly certain that the people who stopped to ask for a photograph were mocking Black Lives Matter.
Also, at this pro-gun rally, they had a poster of the face of Virginia's Governor Northam opposed on the head of Adolf Hitler. So happy Martin Luther King Day in Virginia. All right, let's go on to Bernie and Elizabeth. You sent me an article that I only had a chance to read the opening couple paragraphs, but talk about it. Bernie and Elizabeth, we were talking a lot about this all day. Talk about what the gist of the article is and the argument they made.
Well, it's from Jacobin, Jacobin Magazine. And they analyze how both Bernie and Elizabeth Warren do with Trump voters in their own states, because that in the final analysis, we must beat Trump, right? That's, we must beat him. We cannot hope and rely on the hope that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to be healthy enough to serve another four years on the Supreme Court, let alone live another 4 years. Trump has been packing the federal courts, and we just cannot let him have another 4 years continuing to put unqualified ultra-conservatives on our courts, and certainly not giving him an opportunity to put someone else on the Supreme Court. That said, he must be beat. That said, we must pick the candidate who has the best chance of beating him. That said, that candidate must do one thing. Now, there's several things, but the most important thing that candidate must do is take those Obama voters who went Trump and bring them back into the Democratic fold. Who can take those and also take some of those Trump voters and bring them over? Some of them. But mostly those Obama voters that went Trump, you have to bring them back. You win. And so they analyzed how Elizabeth Warren did in the 2018 midterms when she ran for her Senate seat again, and how Bernie did in the 2018 midterms when he ran for his seat again, with those Trump voters in their own state. Bernie was something like plus 14 with those voters. Elizabeth Warren was something like negative, I think it was negative 7. So she can't even flip the Trump voters in her own state. How is she supposed to do it in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Florida? She can't even do it in her own home state of Massachusetts. And we want to consider putting this up against Trump. Absolutely not. Like, nothing against Warren. You have shown that in your own state, though, that you are not the best qualified person strategically to return the White House to the Democratic Party. Who is? Who has the best record with Trump voters in their own state? It's Bernie. He is the one who has converted more. Every year, every time he's in an election, he consistently outperforms Democrats. Whoever the Democrat running is, if the Democrat gets 55% of the vote, Bernie gets 65. That means that 10% voted for the Republican for the presidency, but voted for Bernie as their senator. He has consistently shown an ability to bring the conservatives over and vote for him. And Warren has not done it in Massachusetts.
Now, what do you think it is about Bernie Sanders that does that?
It's his plain spokenness. It's his sort of populist appeal. I mean, there are people who don't necessarily, you know, they're not socialists. They're not liberals. They're just like a guy who seems like they're on their side. Trump was able to fake that. Like, Bernie does a much better job giving that because it's real and you can feel that it's real. This is not all voters, but with that segment that you need to flip, right? I think they're highly influenced by sort of the personality, the persona, the demeanor, the messaging, whether or not this seems like a guy who's on my side who's going to fight for me, mm-hmm. or a person who's on my side. And a lot of times it's a guy because we live in a sexist world, which we can get back to that Bernie Warren thing later on. And Bernie seems to convince, and when he talks, you know political speak, and you know someone who is talking outside of the mainstream. Trump talks outside of the mainstream. Bernie talks outside of the mainstream political talking. They both do that. And so in the 2016 election, you had Hillary, whose conversations was well within the political mainstream. Trump's conversation was way outside of it. And so he seemed like something different. Bernie also has a conversation, talking points that are way outside of the political mainstream, that talk about the fact that this is a rigged economy, that the people who rigged that economy then rigged the political system with the money they get from the rigged economy. You know that excites people. It gives people the sense that, yeah, this guy's different. And so they both do that. And I think given the choice of those two, that people are going to side with Bernie. There's certainly those Trump voters, those Obama voters who went Trump. Elizabeth Warren's conversation is not going to bring them back.
All right. Now, let's talk about Bernie's appeal to black voters. This is something that I've talked, I don't know if I've ever talked about with you on the show. I talk about it a lot on the show. Joe Biden is doing much better than Bernie among black voters in polls. I'm not sure I completely believe the polls because I have my own issues about the inability of pollsters to adequately decipher what black voters were up to, but let's just stick with the polls. He's doing much better, Biden is, than Bernie. This is 4 years later after Bernie's already run. Bernie seems to have an inability to really win over black voters at a large number, even if the issues he's addressing would be those that would benefit many black voters. So this is something that I scratch my head about all the time. What's your thoughts on this?
I have several. Number one, I remember when Obama was running and Clinton, while Obama was in the race, had an edge in those early states in the black vote. And it wasn't until people got to hear Obama, when he started getting a lot of press coverage, that began to flip. With Bernie, when black voters hear him, they tend to agree with him and side with him. The press seems to have been, they seem to be intentionally ignoring Bernie, not giving him a lot of time. Because we have to remember that the average voter does not pay attention like you and I do. And so whomever the press feeds to the average voter, that's who the average voter hears and gets a chance to understand. I don't think the average black voter has gotten a chance to really hear Bernie. Because those that I know of, and that I've seen, who hear him, like what he has to say. I think we give Bernie the Democratic nomination. You can't ignore him at that point. Bernie gets the nomination. Yeah. He cannot be ignored.
Yeah.
He has to. There's no one else to cover. You cover him and you cover Trump.
Yeah.
And I think that his message will certainly resonate with not just black voters, but voters of, of all kinds.
Well, I'm just laughing because that line is so true. You won't be able to ignore them. Now they will try to trivialize him, and they'll try to marginalize him. They'll try to distort his message because things that Bernie are calling for are things that a lot of powerful people in this country are against. Redistribution, raising taxes on the wealthy so we can have health care for all.
The Republicans might. See, what we have to remember now is that right now the Democrats are trying to marginalize him also.
Yes, that's correct.
Like the outlets that a typical Democratic voter or black voter might tune into are also trying to ignore him. Mm-hmm. We can always count on the Republicans doing that. But once he gets the nomination, all of the pro-Democratic outlets who are trying to get anybody but Bernie are going to have to cover Bernie, and they can't. Unless they want Trump in,
Like, they have to get in line. They have to give them fair coverage. They, again, unless they want sort of party suicide and just hand the thing over to the Republicans again, you have to swallow the fact that Bernie is your nominee and you have to cover him in the best light possible. So if he gets the nomination, all of that is going to change from the more Democratic leaning outlets. Mm-hmm.
One of the homework assignments I gave you, I sent you an article about Michael Bloomberg and his stop and frisk policies. And it was in the New York Times. Interesting article. Michael Bloomberg, of course, is the former mayor of city of New York, a billionaire. The guy is really rich, Troy. He has pledged to spend $1 billion at least in this next campaign. And he says he'll spend it even if it's he doesn't get the nomination. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie get the nomination. Doesn't agree with them. He would still spend it on their behalf. That's real money. As you know, you thought about running for mayor of the city of Chicago, and you had to step back to a large degree because you had no money.
Right.
Money talks. So that's real money. And yet he's having a difficult time. His apology may not sway crucial black voters. Hard line and stop and frisk haunts Bloomberg. I find this fascinating on many levels, the story. Mayor Bloomberg was a big proponent of stop and frisk when he was the mayor of New York City, and they were stopping and frisking a lot of black people. The world has changed dramatically in just 10 years, because that was about 10 years ago, wasn't it? Yeah, 10 years ago. Well, the math, I'm not that great at math, but it was about 10 years ago that stop and frisk. Everybody, it seemed like, except for a few, you know, malcontents like you or me, and Maya maybe, there weren't a lot of people objecting to stop and frisk, at least elected officials. Now Bloomberg's running around apologizing for it. I think that shows a lot about how this country has moved to the left, at least the Democratic Party has moved to the left. Do you think it's insurmountable for him? Is it enough to apologize?
I think what is insurmountable for Michael Bloomberg is Michael Bloomberg. Like, I don't think he can get over just being him. Like, he just doesn't motivate people. He doesn't make me want to get out and vote. He doesn't change my mind when I hear him talk. He just doesn't excite anyone. Unless you're from New York, maybe, and I would imagine half the New Yorkers aren't excited about him. But given that aspect of what's insurmountable, I also think that, you know, I don't know if the stop and frisk piece is insurmountable in terms of the average person's opinion of Michael Bloomberg. I know it's insurmountable for me. Like, if I liked him, if he was an interesting person, if he did have some kind of charisma, that would be my deal breaker. No. But I don't know if the average voters is sort of hard line with on that the way I am or some other folks might be.
Well, I do know that the average voter was supporting it back in. The voters are not perfect. I mean, it was the popular view of police tactics back in the O's that people, it was Democrats were supporting it, trying to show that they were tough and they were getting reelected by Democratic voters.
I remember. I mean, he's subjective. The reason it's insurmountable for me is, my God, man. As someone who grew up having to suffer through many of the insults and humiliations of being targeted by law enforcement unjustly, and then you create a policy to subject millions of people to that kind of humiliating, targeting activity, day in and day out, every day in a city of what, I don't know, how many millions of people in New York now? It was 10, 12 million. I mean, used to always say 8 when we were kids,
eight,
but I would imagine that it's a lot more than that by now.
Well, Chicago fell. We used to go 8 in New York, 3 in Chicago, Chicago's fallen significantly. So,
but subject, you know, whatever the percentage of the black population of that 8 million is, that kind of daily harassment, targeting, unjust, humiliating treatment. It's like, you don't get it, man. You just don't get it. And I still don't think he gets it. Because he's apologized, but he's never talked about the human impact of that policy, man. You are fucking people over and humiliating him every single day. So, no, that's a deal breaker for me. But I don't think the average person looks at it that way, unfortunately.
I have to agree with you on that one. And I think Michael Bloomberg will have a big role before all is said and done. Because, like I said, $1 billion is serious change. And he's got a commercial coming out on the Super Bowl. And then Trump, when he heard that, came back with his commercial, or maybe it was the other way around. I'm looking at Rob Markwick, my next guest. He can't remember either. But I think Bloomberg was the one who came out with the commercial first. He's our bonus guest after this show. But what the hell? Sit down, Markwick. And State Senator Rob Markwick. I was almost calling him state rep, but I remembered he was promoted of sorts. Bloomberg, $1 billion is going to kick in the race. What impact, Rob, do you think Bloomberg is going to have on this Democratic race?
It's such a wild card, isn't it? I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, he draws off moderate centrist Democrats. I assume, you know, you'd assume that he would hurt Biden the most, right? Because he's not going to, I can't imagine Bernie supporters are going to say, oh, Bloomberg, let's go for him. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's where I think. I mean, Biden's, you know, in a strong position, but it could be just enough to pull him out.
Mm-hmm. Well, the positive of it is if he's going to kick in $1 billion in this campaign, that's a lot of ads. It'll be anti-Trump ads. I do not believe Michael Bloomberg, I'm with Troy, in a million years will be the Democratic nominee. I just don't see that happening. And he's so late in the game anyway.
Yeah.
But $1 billion, Troy LaRavier, is some serious money, and that's just going to be attacking Trump. He seems to have a personal grudge against Donald Trump. I don't blame him for having a personal grudge against Donald Trump.
And Ben, we were talking about it yesterday. We were starting to compare, you know, Pritzker. He's a billionaire, got $1 billion. But Pritzker put the legwork in, right?
Yeah, that was the difference that I was drawing when I was talking to Dennis about this. J.B. Pritzker went around the entire state of Illinois, built his alliances, has got people to support him on the local level, and that enabled him to sustain some rocky moments in that campaign. Like, mm-hmm. for instance, I don't know if this is ancient history, Troy LaRavier.
I remember.
You remember when the ads broke, when the Tribune got a hold of tapes where Pritzker and Blagojevich were making fun of various black elected officials,
yeah.
And here was the Democratic, and he had already brought over, he already won the support of many black elected officials. They have press conferences mm-hmm. for him. We forgive him, this, that, and the other. Right. He had put in his time
right.
And built.
In Pritzker's defense, he wasn't making fun. Blagojevich was saying more of the negative stuff, and Pritzker was kind of going, seemed to be going along with
that's
it.
Exactly that's exactly correct. Memory. That yeah. is, that's correct. He was like, yeah,
and I
funny.
Wasn't a big Pritzker supporter, but you know. Right is right.
You know, wait, time out. Yes, right is right. I sit corrected. He was sort of chortling at Blagojevich's antics. I can't remember, Troy, who did you support in the 2018?
Kennedy.
Chris Kennedy.
Yep.
Whose greatest contribution, of course, was the line that Mayor Rahm's planning policies were forcing black people out of the city of Chicago. Irrefutable yep. line,
that
by the way.
That was it. He just said it. Yeah. And you remember when I had my campaign, you know, my campaign was a big part of it was that Rob's message to working people in Chicago is get the hell out. You know, that's his message. You shut down their schools and so they don't have a place to walk the kids to school, get the hell out. You shut down housing opportunities and you restrict vouchers, your message is get the hell out. You ticket them to the point where they can't afford to drive and you tow their cars. Your message is get the hell out. And so to hear Kennedy say it, he didn't say get the hell out, but to just say it like that, you know, I wasn't a big supporter of anybody. You know, I was Kennedy bis for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really pretty much that line that made me go, all right, I'm going to just get behind this guy.
I thought you were the reason he had the line.
I actually think, and I'm not sure, I think it might have been Amara.
Amara
was one of his advisors.
Yeah.
And I know Amara told me that when I asked. I was like, was that you? And she sort of, you know, I don't know if she was telling the truth or not, but she sort of shook her head and was as if it was her that advised him to do that.
2019 Chicago mayoral candidate Amara Enya?
Yes, that Amara Enya. Oh. Yeah. Thank you. Very good for knowing that. We have Troy LaRavier in the studio. Rob Markwick is with us as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Troy what's really on his mind. Then we'll break down the show in preparation for our bonus interview with State Senator Rob Markwick. We'll be right back after this. Hey, everybody. What you're about to hear are the piano stylings of Jeff Manuel. Man, listen to Jeff go. Jeff Manuel has been playing piano around Chicago for years. He's played for conventions, for celebrities, played in basement bars with blues bands. He's played at prestigious social clubs, fine restaurants, and in the intimacy of private homes. Book Jeff Manuel at jeffmanuelpianist.com. Don't worry, I'll spell his name at the end of this commercial. You know what Chicago Magazine said? They said that Jeff Manuel is, quote, as comfortable with Chopin as he is with Cole Porter. He's excellent, and his performance is joyous. He offers an elegant stream of compositions and interpretations that entertains the mind but won't hurt the ears. To hear more of Jeff Manuel's work and to book Jeff for your next event, go to jeffmanuelpianist.com. I'm going to spell it out for you, people. J-E-F-F. M as in Mary, A, N as in Nancy, U, E, L, P, I, A, N, I, S, T.com. Take it away, Jeff Manuel.
So this idea is a bunch of malarkey.
Welcome back to the Ben Jarofsky Show, live from the Chicago Sun-Times.
Troy LaRavier is still in the studio, and we're going to ask him what's on his mind before we head out the door. Dennis, you have an update for me before we do that?
Absolutely, I do. We're going to go to you in the live stream chat room before we get out of here. We got Rob Markwick in for our bonus interview today. I'm leaving it up to you guys in the live stream chat. Do we keep open the live stream? Do we keep it going? Do we jump back on YouTube and record our interview with Rob Markwick? It's up to you, live stream chat room. If you've got nothing going on today, we'd love to do it. So, weigh in, and by the end of the show, I'll see what you guys say, and we'll base our answer off of that. But let's read your comments today on the YouTube live stream chat. Everybody weighing in. I think all of you people are awesome. Like-minded political people hanging out together on the Ben Jarofsky Show YouTube live chat. All right, we got Dragon Slayer 19. I don't know about 18 and the others, but we got Dragon Slayer 19 here, all right? Dragon Slayer 19 says, Warren, talking about Elizabeth Warren, Warren is being mostly annoying for attacking Bernie instead of hitting Biden on bankruptcy, etc., especially since her political career is basically a reaction to how bad Biden's has been.
You know what? Dragon Slayer is a pretty astute follower of politics, Troy or Rob. I don't know if you know this, but what he's saying, or she, I don't know if Dragon Slayer is a man or a woman, but whatever, is absolutely true. Elizabeth Warren's career largely developed to her from her opposition to the bankruptcy law of, I think it was 2005. And Joe Biden was a big supporter of that bankruptcy law in many ways that protected the interest of credit card companies, that law, and left working people vulnerable. And Elizabeth Warren really established her identity or political identity from leading the opposition. And Joe Biden, as an incumbent state senator at the time from Delaware, was one of the leading Democratic voices. It was one of those things where Democrats are proving how they can work with Republicans and that bipartisanship did not really work into the best interest of working people. So Dragon Slayer, very astute analyst there.
Our good friend Kyle weighed in on the YouTube live stream chat and says, this whole handshake thing is gutter politics, like a goon in hockey. It's trash.
Yeah, it really irritated the hell out of me that it became such an issue But I think I stand by what I said, even without any evidence of it. My sense of it, it was that it was something concocted by some strategist in the Elizabeth Warren campaign who thought it would be a good idea to provoke a confrontation with Bernie to sort of exacerbate what they've detected, the weak support he had among women who are still women voters who are still upset about the fight with Hillary Clinton 2016. It sure smells like a strategist tact. What do you think? You think I'm onto something there, Troy?
Yeah, I think you are. I also think there might even be more nefarious motivations behind that, or just plain stupidity.
Well, stupidity, I do think it was a stupid tactic.
Yeah.
I think it hurt Elizabeth Warren. Not shaking his hand, come on, you know. Like, I'm so mad. Like, you're in politics. People say worse things all the time. Hell, read half the stuff they say about me, Troy, on the internet. You know?
It's like, why? One, she did it at a time where he was surging. Just surging in the polls. And this is not going to stop it. You're basically taking the person who looks like he might be the nominee and trying to give him a handicap. Trying to tamp down and stop some of the momentum that he has and is certainly going to need when he goes up against Trump. Like, you know, I hate to say this because I've heard people say it in ways that I think are not genuine, but it seems like all this does is could potentially help Trump, because it's certainly not going to help Elizabeth Warren. At the end of the day, I don't think it'll help anyone. I think it's BS and it'll blow over. But it's like, why? Why would you risk handicapping the person who looks as if he's going to be one who's closest to you in terms of political perspective, and then also looks like he'll carry much of your perspective into a head-to-head contest with Trump, because no one else is going to carry it? Why would you do that? I don't get it.
And Troy, looks like someone in our live stream chat is throwing you in the hot seat here. I'm going to ask you the question in just a moment here. But first, we got to award our live chat champion for today. Our live chat champion is none other than our good friend Dragonslayer19 with his comment on the Chicago Tribune and the New York Times endorsement. Dragonslayer19 says, first time they need to decide. Well, this is on the New York Times endorsement more than anything. First time that they need to decide between two women, vastly different candidates. They can't decide? F that!
No,
and he didn't say F.
It was pretty pathetic. Come on, New York Times. Take a stand, all right?
Dragonslayer19, congratulations. You are today's live chat champion. You win nothing.
That was. What about the blue Mustang?
No? Nope.
We're not giving those away anymore?
All right, Troy, we're throwing you in the hot seat here, buddy. Let's see. It's Brianna, former live chat champion, by the way. Brianna weighed in with her question here. What grade does Troy LaRavier give Lori Lightfoot so far as mayor?
And Troy is a former Chicago Public School teacher and principal, assistant principal. He's got to come up with a grade. Right.
So let me just go ahead and play this again.
Jesus, man. I mean, I could do a cop-out and say incomplete.
Well, that means like the New York Times. It's good enough
for
them.
But I'm not going to do that. So much of that grade is based on my experience with the Chicago Public Schools and what's happening differently and what's not. Uh-huh. And we have a board that behaves differently, but that board seems to allow the people who actually run CPS to do the exact same crap they were doing under Rom.
Rob Marley
agrees with Troy. So and also Lori has not lived up to some of the things she told me she was going to do, like get principals involved in decision making. She hasn't even come close. She hasn't even started. And so through that experience, my grade is F.
Whoa. Dang, he's tough. Like, I'd hate to have him for a teacher.
I mean, it might be an F plus.
Oh my God, there we go.
Never mind. But it's an F. Through that experience. I mean, there's a lot of open government stuff that's happening that looks nice, but when you see what's happening underneath and the people who are running stuff, things are happening the exact same way, but she's putting a really nice, pleasant, soft face to it that encompass many of the sort of things that we want to see as progressives, you know, in terms of open government stuff, but it's like, we're going to have an open government and we're still going to screw you over through this open government. So yeah, F plus, D minus.
That's total overall grade or just on the issue of treating?
That's on the issue of the issues that I'm closest with, which are the issues in Chicago public schools and education. There may be other areas where she's excelling, but I'm going to grade the one that I know best. And that one is, and particularly the strike, man, the way that went down in terms of teachers having to fight for what she promised she would do. Mm-hmm. In terms of increasing staffing and just how incredibly understaffed our school district is, and that they had to fight so hard just to try and get something close to adequate staffing. Mm-hmm. That was disappointing.
Well, Rob Martwick, you're in the hot seat. Should we ask Senator Martwick to give a grade as well, D?
Rob Martwick. What grade?
I've set the bar pretty low.
Yeah, the bar is very, very low, although F plus, I don't know.
So, you know, I as you might be aware, the mayor and I had a bit of a personal interaction during the campaign, and I've learned from that she gets an A plus no matter what she does with me. No,
Markwick learned his lesson.
No, you know, it's hard to say. So I will talk from my experience, Troy, which was... her ability to accomplish things down in Springfield. And I think that, again, in this shows, and this isn't really a knock on her. I mean, I guess it is because you suffer for it. But the explanation is that she hasn't done this before. Right? She's not done this before. This is new. And so she comes down to Springfield, a complicated place with a lot of 177 super A-type, self-absorbed egomaniacs who all think that they're the smartest and most important person in the world, and you've got to get something accomplished there, and big stuff, right? She needed to get this stuff done for the Chicago casino. She needed breathing room on pensions. She needed the ability to change the transfer tax to get more revenue into the city of Chicago. She got none of it, and the feeling was that her staff wasn't engaging. No one was being called, right? No one was being called and said, hey, can you give me your vote? And sometimes that's all it takes, is just, will you help me? Mm-hmm. And even that wasn't happening. So I think I'm not going to, I've been in trouble once before. So I'm going to go with Troy's first part, incomplete. But I also want to point out that the things he talked about with the school district shows exactly why we need an elected school board. Mm. Right, because it doesn't matter the intentions going in. The bottom line is this city is an enormous responsibility to run, and CPS by itself is an incredibly enormous opportunity. And when one person thinks they can do all those jobs, they fail at them.
That is is just a hint of some of the conversation we'll have with Rob Markwick when we do the bonus, because I'm going to ask him about the elected school board. I'm going to ask him about how life is different in Springfield, or will be different in the state Senate with John Cullerton no longer in charge. All these issues. Will the state Senate be a little more progressive? Or will they go back to their old games of going right to the middle? These are kinds of issues that we'll be talking about with Rob Markwick. But before we do that, Troy, you had some things on your mind that you wanted to get off your out of your mind, out of your chest, so to speak, having to do with the pay rate of principals. The floor is yours.
After the teacher contract, the ink on the contract was dry, like even before it was dry, I got a lot of calls from principals and assistant principals saying, okay, the teachers are getting 15% over 5 years. What are we getting? I can't get my best teachers to become assistant principals because they don't want to take a pay cut. That is the situation we've gotten in the last decade or so, where teacher salary hikes, which we believe they deserve. We're glad they got them because that gives us the ability to recruit good people into teaching positions. But the relative stagnation of the administrative pay scale means that good teachers don't want to take assistant principal jobs anymore because they literally have to take a pay cut. We did a Freedom of Information Act request with CPS 4 months ago,
they delayed it. We asked for the hourly rates of assistant principals and principals. How much per hour do they get paid? And along with teachers, so that we can compare, because principals work an entire year and so do assistant principals. They don't get the summer off. They don't get a winter break off. They don't get spring break off. So the best way to determine the relative value that CPS places on their work is to look at their hourly rates. And so we asked for the hourly rates. They asked for a one-week extension. A week went by, no hourly rates. They asked for a 15-day extension. I said no. They took it anyway, no hourly rates. They asked for another 15-day and another 15-day. We had to send a letter letting them know we were going to sue them before they actually released. They released the hourly rates on December 20th, the date our lawsuit was supposed to be filed. And this is what the data showed, and you can see why they didn't want it out. The average experienced teacher in CPS, now remember, the career trajectory is experienced teacher, assistant principal, mm-hmm. principal.
Okay.
That's the career. So you would imagine the salary goes up. These are the numbers. The average experienced teacher, and by experienced teacher, I mean a teacher with a master's degree and 10 or more years of teaching. There are 9,500 teachers in CPS who fit that. Almost half of the teaching force is an experienced teacher, 9,500 of them. The average experienced teacher hourly rate is $70.32 an hour. $70.32, average experienced teacher. Should that teacher be asked by her principal, you're exhibiting some great leadership qualities on your team, you know, assistant principal position is coming up, I'd like you to think about taking it. That teacher would have to go from $70.32 per hour to a starting assistant principal wage of $49.52 an hour. Over a $20 per hour drop. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they would have to work. They'd have to give up their summers, give up their winter breaks, give up their spring break, just so they could work enough hours to get back to the salary they had as a teacher. Mm-hmm. Now, this is important because one of the greatest impacts, besides the teacher, on student learning and achievement is school leadership. And if we can't get good people to become school leaders, because the road to the principalship is through the assistant principal position. If we can't get our best teachers to take assistant principal positions, then we suffer in terms of the overall quality of school leadership that eventually is available to our young people. And so they go from $70 to $49. And then the starting principal salary is $60. You're still $10 short. When you become a principal, the starting salary is $60 per hour, right? And so you're still short by $10 of the hourly wage you made as a teacher. Now, of course, principals work more hours, and so eventually their pay, most principals will make more in a year than their teachers do because they have to work through the summer. But to work through all of that, to have to go through that much just to barely beat out your teachers in salary, that's insane. That is not a compensation system that's going to attract and retain the best people for our teachers. I asked the principal about this, and here's a quote. I showed her the numbers, and I said, in her school, she supervises over 130 people who are in a higher hourly rate wage than she does. And so do her APs. And so I said, well, how does this make you feel? She said, it's discouraging, especially when you consider that most administrators work well over 40 hours a week. I average $70 to $80 hours a week. I know my APs work nearly as many. On top of the time demand placed on administrators to supervise extracurricular events as a large school, we also take on the extra workload of hosting evening and summer school regularly without any additional compensation. I also say I feel foolish at times. My APs and I often laugh at the fact that we could literally make more money as bartenders when we consider how much we get paid in relationship to the hours we actually work.
Yeah. I'm with you. So what do you think the CPS should do?
I think CPS and the mayor need to make the public
aware of just how important the role of the principal, the assistant principal, and teachers in general in education is, so that the public will want to support investments in the system, investments that will enable CPS to set not just teacher salaries, but administrator salaries at a level that will recruit and retain the best of them so that our children do not lose them. Mm-hmm. That's what I think they should do.
I'm with you on everything you said except the first thing you said. I wrote it down. I'm going to take issue with you and get your response to this. I think you were talking about a conversation you were having with a principal, and you said the person said, "I want my best teachers to become assistant principals. How could I do that with this?" I'm not certain I want my best teachers to become assistant principals. I think I want my best teachers to remain my best teachers. I'm thinking that the qualities that translates into be an outstanding teacher are not necessarily the qualities that translate into being an outstanding assistant principal. So I would like a salary sale that would reward teachers for being teachers and not tell a teacher, well, if you want to make more money, you have to leave the classroom where you're having your direct impact on students. Your response.
So there's two things there. Number one, when you understand the job of an assistant principal and the principal, part of that job is to teach teachers, right? You have to build up the whole teaching capacity of your school, and you're not going to do that if you're promoting mediocre teachers to assistant principal positions. You have to promote the best. You have to promote the brightest, because one of their main responsibilities is to coach other teachers and create an environment in which they can all become just as good as they were. Because quiet as is kept, and contrary to popular belief, teaching is not something you're just born like a talent you just have. You learn how to do it, and you need the best teachers in assistant principal positions to help people develop those skills. And in relationship to your other comment, that's not an either or thing. One of the things that we fought for quite a while, but we don't get in this system, is some kind of extra lane for teachers so that great teachers don't necessarily have to step out of the classroom, that they can share a lot of that knowledge with by taking a lead teacher position, for example, that gives them extra pay. So sharing all of that knowledge, take positions that in which they can share a lot of that knowledge with their colleagues while they remain in the classroom. And maybe, you know, we take one class away from them or two classes away from them so they can have the time that they need to coach other teachers. We would love for something like that to happen. So it's not an either or. It's a both and.
All right, fair enough. Well, let me ask you this question. Rob, you look like
I'm just listening, and I'm fascinated by it because Troy has such, you know, on the ground knowledge of what goes on there. But I find it fascinating as I hear you talk about this inverse situation where technically on an hourly basis you've got a step down in pay. It's the opposite of the charter school model. So the charter school model, your principals and your assistant principals, whoever is administering the school, is getting paid huge dollars, and then they bring in these kids right out of college, and they pay them nothing, and they churn them and burn them and kick them out after a couple of years, yeah, or burn them out after a couple of years. And so it's like the complete reverse of that model.
That's,
you know,
a good point. And to that point, that's an excellent point you make there. I would say this, Troy, part of the reason why the public schools teachers have the benefits they do in relation to the charter school teachers is they have a strong union, and they
I'm
go
so
on
glad
strike.
You said that. And I'm so glad
he said
Senator
that.
Senator Martwick is here, because one of the things that we want is to extend, because principals in Illinois don't have collective bargaining.
Yes.
Principals in New York have collective bargaining. Principals in California have collective bargaining. And in Maryland, they have collective bargaining in about 20 different states. So to be a state with a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and a Democrat in the governor's office that continues to deny collective bargaining to school administrators seems somewhat odd to me. So as a result, right now there is a bill, language for a bill, on a certain legislator's desk who's not in this room. And we're hoping to get support for it so that school administrators can also use the power of collective bargaining to advocate for themselves and the students and families that they serve. Because That way, when the next time the teachers are on strike, they're not out there alone. That they have this respected voice of school principals who feel more empowered to speak out and not be silent.
And as you say that, I helped walk those picket lines. And I'll tell you what, at almost every school that I walked a picket line on, those principals were out there with their teachers, but there's nothing in it for them.
Well, not only, okay, this is a change. Now we're on a tangent. With this is a change, and Troy knows where I'm going. When I first met Troy, all right, it was in 2014, I want to say, when he wrote that essay for My Beloved Bright One. I was like, there was this essay that just told about how Mayor Rahm and the bureaucracy at the Board of Education uses principals as props in their propaganda campaigns, and that this was one principal, Troy Larvier, who wasn't going to allow himself to be used as a prop. Immediately called him up. We had coffee, and the rest is history. So I welcome this collective bargaining bill. I'm going to get the information when we're off air. I'm going to write a story about it, bring people on. I welcome it. Because one of the things that's been traditional in Chicago public schools, and Troy knows I'm speaking the truth here, that principals have been used the like little props in a public relation game by whatever mayor was running the show to diminish whatever claims the teachers were making, to diminish whatever claims parent activists were making, to diminish whatever claims troublemakers like Markwick were making. Principals were used. So the principal may go on the picket line and tell the teacher, I'm with you, but that's like a private thing. Publicly, those principals, if they say anything, they'll be like chirping whatever the boss says. What do you think about that, Troy Larvier?
I mean, that was the situation. And I think that was the situation, but I wouldn't say it was... They had a few principals they would bring out. Pat Basileri was one of them. And if when my article got published, three principals came out and publicly risked their careers as well to say Troy's right. And they went and dug up Pat Basileri to come out and say, well, I'm not afraid to speak, and I think the district respects my position. They always have a few. And oftentimes those few, since they're the only ones who you typically see in the paper, people sort of get this sense that that's what principals are like, because every time you see a representation of principal voice, it's someone who they've picked who's willing to echo and parrot what they've said. But that's a select group of people who typically stand against the prevailing opinion of 90% of the principals in the district. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, we'll see where this bill goes. I'm delighted by this collective. I'm for collective bargaining for everybody. I'm a big union guy. The union support this show. So why not the principal? Why not the principals?
It's not a bill yet. It's a draft. It's going to be a while.
Oh, so he's got Markwick's already volunteered to run the bill.
All right.
All right. It all happens on the Ben Jarofsky Show. All right. We are going to close down the regular portion of the show, take a break, and then bring back State Senator Rob Markwick for a bonus interview. I want to thank Troy Larvier, Maya Dukmasova, and, of course, Rachel Ventura was a surprise guest. She's running in the Democratic primary on the 11th Congressional District against incumbent Congressman Bill Foster. It's a really interesting race out there. Rachel Ventura is sort of the Bernie persuasion. She comes at it from the left, and Bill Foster is more of a mainstream moderate Democrat. So we'll see how that goes down. Rachel Ventura, thanks for coming out. And of course, could not do this show today or any day without the man, the myth, the legend, the pride of joy in Alton, Illinois, and the State Senator Rob Markwick and Troy Larvier could tell you. Back home in Alton, they call him White Lightning. Looking very good with a tie on today. Give yourself a raise, take it out of petty cash.
Hey, and remember, you can download previous Ben Jarofsky shows and Benny J bonus interviews at both Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Reader websites and wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. Speaking of Benny J bonus interviews, we're going live with our interview with Senator Rob Markwick. Just give us about 20 minutes and we'll be right back on the YouTube live stream chat. I got to cut today's show up for all the downloaders. You know what I mean? So check us out on YouTube. If not, you can download that interview. I think it'll be up on Sunday. There we go. At Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Reader websites, wherever else you download your favorite podcast, it'll also be available on YouTube after we end the interview. We'll see you Wednesday.